the time, and we're going to move towards the Sorrento Writers Festival, which is running from next Thursday right through to Sunday. We've got on the line Henry Reynolds, historian, who is going to be part of a session on Friday the 24th of April, Australian History, Reframing the Past, Realising the Future. Good morning, Henry.
Oh, good morning.
Yeah, and we're, you know, pretty happy to be talking to you about this. You have been instrumental in changing the way European Australians understand the history of this place. Can you tell us a little bit about what you think are key important elements to this discussion?
The main area that I became involved in was the place of Indigenous Australians and the First Nations, both Aborigines and Torres Strait Islanders, because I moved when I was a very young academic to Townsville, North Queensland, where obviously you were in daily contact with Indigenous people, and you developed close friendships and an outer circle of people you knew, and then lots of people you just came across, as you do in any social situation. So but not only was I living there, but I was teaching the students, and obviously mainly the local white kids. I was teaching Australian history. And so you bring those two things together, and I realised that Australian history, at that point, had almost nothing to say about the Aborigines. They'd virtually been written out of the story. So that was the beginning, and I persisted with that for a long, long time. I mean, my first major book, The Other Side of the Frontier, over 40 years ago now, and so it's been a very, very long crusade, I suppose, that I engaged on, not so much because who I was, but where I was, and that obviously has had a dramatic impact over the long term on Australian history generally.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? I was brought up in a country town in Victoria, and of course Victoria, because of its temperate climate, was part of the destruction almost immediately of part of the frontier wars. But I can remember myself feeling the deafening silence around Indigenous role in the country, because there's a settlement there called Framlingham. So I went on a journey of my own on this, hardly not fighting at the same level as you, but in a certain personal consciousness. But what I find a bit odd is that it's one generation of people that have finally woken up to the horror on the European side.
Yeah. Well, the odd thing about it was that if you are doing historical research, you realise that in the 19th century, people had no doubt about what was happening and the violence. The debate wasn't, is there a lot of violence? The debate was a matter of, is it necessary? Is this an inevitable consequence of colonisation? It was the morality, not the existence of conflict and fighting. And by the century, by the 1880s, there was a very, no literate Australian person, Australian-born or immigrant, no literate person could not be aware, because there was Queensland was the standout state in a colony in a way. And the major newspaper, the weekly called The Queenslander, for 6 months. 6 months had an ongoing campaign to talk about the conflict in a series of many, many editorials, a great number of people writing in, the whole series called The Way We Civilize, and this was then published as an important pamphlet. So, you know, no one in that debate said, oh, no, you're wrong, it's all been peaceful. As I say, it was a debate about different things. Now, what happened between then, sort of, say, the centenary of colonisation, 1888, and into the 20th century and federation and, you know, the establishment of the Australian state, was that gradually all this was left behind. And so when I came to teach Australian history, I mean, the major book that was being used all over Australia for senior schools and universities, it only had two mentions of the Aborigines, and they were just said in passing. It's astonishing. They had been written out of the history in a generation. Now, that meant that the people that I, you know, that I grew up with, and particularly when I was teaching, they'd been, you know, up to two generations of people who'd been told, had learned a history which had virtually left the Aborigines out of the story. And that, you know, and people were inclined to learn things, you know, when they're young and going to school and in their teenage years, they learn things then that they keep with them the rest of their life. So I realised that I was, in a way, I was battling against that two generations of neglect and ignoring and simply not talking about violence or the frontier.
I'm a history student at uni, Henry, so I feel a bit starstruck talking to you because you're the person that we get kind of given readings from. But the thing that when I'm listening to what you're talking about, it brings up for me a discussion that we've had in some of my units about the shift in historical study around who was the subject of study and who we write histories for. And I think the period of time that you were starting out was a really pivotal moment for focus in history, moving away from histories of essentially European colonies and great wars and great historical figures to creating a more diverse representation of who's being studied, who's being looked at, and whose stories are being told. I'd really love to know how your attempts to create a more accurate picture of Australian history were received by your peers and your community.
Badly.
Obviously, there's the Keith Windschuttle debacle, but in your kind of day-to-day life, how receptive were people to this information?
Well, very, very mixed, obviously. Very mixed. I mean, let's start with the profession. Now, when I began, as I said, there was, you know, I got no encouragement from the generation. You know, I was a very young, and they, you know, they were chaps in their 50s and 60s, the leaders of the profession. And I got very little encouragement from them. But on the other hand, from a very early stage, I got, I got a whole year after year, I got big research grants from the Australian Research Council, which enabled me to go all over Australia. I mean, every part of Australia, every library and archive over a 10-year period, and that was all paid for in by research grants. So I can't say I wasn't encouraged, because in that sense, I was.
Well, that's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's part of that deeply uncomfortable sense that we've all got, I mean, the country really needed to wake up.
The most interesting story is with what happened with the other side of the frontier. Now, I'd spent 10 years from 1970 to 1980, basically, going all over Australia. I literally wanted to find out if what I learned about North Queensland was true all over Australia, because, you know, as far as I knew, and there wasn't much historical writing about it. So I had to go all around Australia looking and to see if the story I had learned about in the north of Queensland was replicated elsewhere. So, I did all that work. Now, I sat down, I had a 3-month-long service leave, and I sat down, look, I've got all of this vast amount of paper, because it was all paper then. What am I going to do? It's time I sat down and wrote a book. And how would I do it? Would I say, well, on the one hand, this is what was happening to the First Nations. On the other hand, this is what the colonists were doing. And I suddenly thought, look, no, I really have to write a story, firstly, from the Aboriginal point of view, and then from the settlers. And I wasn't even sure that there was enough material. Because, you know, I've been collecting bits and pieces, you know, from all sorts of sources. And I sort of gathered all these bits of paper together, and I realised that, yes, I could really could write a book called The Other Side of the Frontier. Now, I sent it off to the two leading publishers then, Australian publishers, that's Penguin Australia, and which was very active then, and Allen and Unwin. Now, Allen and Unwin wrote back and said, oh, yes, this is quite interesting, but we think there are numerous areas where, you know, you could put more work into it. But Penguin was the extraordinary one. They wrote back and said, well, we're very sorry, but we think there are already too many books about the Aborigines.
Wow.
So we published it ourselves, the History Department in Townsville, as a self-published book. And, of course, it took off.
An earthquake.
We got, you know, the History Department office became, largely booksellers, packaging and sending packets of books off. And, of course, Penguin realised their error and said, oh, quick, we'd love to publish. And so the first public, the best-known edition was the first Penguin edition. But that was after it had sort of been knocked back. So, a very odd history, actually.
Mm-hmm. And you've got another book coming out that you're going to be speaking about at the Sorrento Writers Festival coming up on the 24th of April, so it's coming up pretty soon. Did you want to talk to us a little bit about what you're exploring in this upcoming book, Looking from the North?
Well, this is very much a result of, as I say, of living. We went to North Queensland. That's, my wife Margaret and I. She later became a senator for North Queensland. Most people went to North Queensland for a year or two and then came back south. This is still the case in many parts of North Australia, particularly in Darwin. Rapid turnover of people. But we, for one reason or other, we stayed. We stayed for more than 30 years, and our children grew up there, and we became really completely immersed in North Queensland. Now, that meant that it also meant that my students, a lot of students who did, because I felt at the very start, I've got to put special weeks have got to be set aside for the history of North Queensland in particular, because if not, they will get the impression that nothing of national importance has ever happened in their part of Australia, because there was not much, it was just left out of most of the histories. So that meant that a lot of students, dozens of them, then over the years did honours and masters and PhDs about local history, and because our experience was that people say, "Oh no, it's too regional. We won't publish that book." We published most of them ourselves, and we published something like 40 books. Pretty extraordinary. But it did mean that we were building up this very, very large knowledge of the history of North Australia. And
it's fascinating that they should say something's too regional, because in actual fact, specific versus global, this is the whole nature of writing. I mean, it's ludicrous.
No, they'd say, look, this is a good book, but there's not much market, you know.
Yeah.
You know, all Australian publishing is, commercial. And they just said, well, we just don't think we could sell, enough books about this remote part of Australia. So that was why we published the books ourselves. But anyway, it did mean that we began to build up a very, very large knowledge of North Australia. And, of course, eventually I came to realise that we weren't just sort of adding on to Australian history, like putting on a new shed at the back of the house. We were finding that it really was a very distinctive and different story.
Yeah.
And so it really is this distinctive story about North Australia. And, even now, you see, people sort of don't quite realise that it's 45%, north of Capricorn, it's 45% of the Australian landmass, but only 5% of the population. And so the history of the colonisation of the north is so utterly different. And in a way, it's the story of the failure of colonisation, unlike in the south, where the very, very soon the First Nations people were overwhelmed, as much as anything, just by numbers.
Yeah.
Whereas in the north, this never happened. And so, if you look at the north as it developed, its early period of colonisation, there were the Pacific Islanders who basically allowed the sugar industry to develop, because you had to have cheap labour or you couldn't compete with Fiji and Mauritius.
And so what you're really going on to is the underlying slavery of the economy of Australia.
Well, you see, of course slavery often kicked it off, but by the end of the period, this was a thing which the islanders chose to do. Many of them had come a second and a third time, and many of them stayed in Australia and became settlers in their own right.
Yeah, I remember reading a story when I was a kid called Pastures of the Blue Crane, which was about people who were islanders in the cane fields. It was a novel.
Yeah. Well, as I said, they became, they became successful colonists themselves. But of course, they all got expelled. But anyway, that's another story. That's part of the story. Now, there's also a clear case where all the labour for the pastoral industry, which was absolutely critical right across the north, from the Pacific to the Indian Ocean, the great tropical savanna, open grassland, this was the northern pastoral industry, overwhelmingly the workforce for the local Aborigines, because there was no other alternative. And so they stayed on their country. They had to manage the white boss, but they stayed on their own country and, weren't pushed off because...
They had some economic use.
Well, they weren't just the main labour, but they were so good at it.
Mm.
In a very short space of time, the young people became, horse people of great skill. They knew the country. They could track animals. They knew everything. They knew the country in a way that, you know, a white manager, and often one or two white workers simply couldn't. So they were absolutely critical right across the north. And then there were the Chinese who came into the north and became major players in the development. I mean, if you look at Cairns, now Cairns and the area around it was, at least a quarter and higher Chinese. And the Chinese weren't, you know, coolie labourers. They were highly well-educated, many of them, you know, with capital. They bought in from Hong Kong and Singapore, and they developed the local industry. So then the same is true of the Japanese and the pearling industry. So the development of the North was a multicultural operation. And this is, I mean, the critical thing was there were never enough white colonists. And the fundamental difference was that the British in the South provided 150,000 convict men and women, young people straight into the workforce, could be made to work anywhere, cheap labour. And this didn't happen. Now, if they put 150,000 young British and Irish men and women in the north, it may have been utterly different, but they didn't. I mean, by then, and the whole fundamental difference is that south of Capricorn, the colonisation was a British effort, of part of the British Empire. North of Capricorn, it was the colonisation by the Australian settlers themselves, by the government, the self-government to come for Queensland and for South Australia and Northern Territory. And it was a colonial operation, not a British Empire operation.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
Well, it's
hugely different.
It's a fundamental difference, which you just, you wonder why ever didn't I think about this before?
Well, we have to finish because we've run out of time. But we could obviously talk to you forever. The Australian history, reframing the past, realizing the future. You're going to be sharing the stage with Rachel Perkins.
That's right. That's right.
And before you go, I think we better plug the brilliant Australian Wars program that I think you contributed to. Rachel hosts it. Great.
Yes.
It's a three-part series that goes over the frontier wars. Would recommend.
That's right. That's why you guys have been paired, I guess.
Oh, yes. And, of course, we produced a book based on a series called The Australian Wars. So this came out at almost the same week as my book about the North.
Perfect timing.
<Yeah. laughs>
And of course, if anybody wants to hear this fantastic session, it's on the 24th at on Friday the 24th in Sorrento, where all the best people will obviously be from Thursday through to Sunday.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much for talking to us today, Henry Reynolds.
That's a pleasure. Okay, bye-bye.